From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Barbara Bush has written her memoirs. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with the former First Lady about her family life and her public life. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new reissue, Webb Pierce, King of the Honky Tonk. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Speaker of the House of Representatives says his chamber may vote as early as next week on a possible U.S.-led Haiti invasion. Tom Foley says he and Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell will meet with Republican leaders to talk about the GOP's request to take an invasion vote. Foley says some Democrats also want the vote on authorizing American action, but he stressed that in his view, the Constitution doesn't require the president to get the Congress's okay before sending troops to Haiti. Foley wouldn't speculate on how the vote might turn out. If an invasion of Haiti occurs, troops from Fort Drum, New York, and Fort Bragg, North Carolina, are expected to play a major role. Adam Hochberg of member station WUNC is at Fort Bragg and says preparations are underway.
Convoys of military vehicles leave Fort Bragg every couple of hours, carrying armor and artillery and communications equipment. The equipment is on its way to the North Carolina State Port, where it will be loaded onto Navy ships and taken to the waters off Haiti. Military officials won't say when troops from Fort Bragg might be sent to Haiti as well, but some soldiers here say they've been told to be ready to leave within 10 days.
Reporter Adam Hochberg in Fayetteville, North Carolina. The shores of Havana are deserted today for the first time in weeks. Cuban police are now preventing rafters from trying to flee the island in homemade boats. The deal is a result of the new U.S.-Cuban agreement to stop the increasing numbers of refugees. NPR's Maria Hinojosa is in Havana, and she says Cubans are obeying the new rules.
What we do know is that there was some slight police presence along some of the major send-off points close to Havana. Not major police presence, but there was some police presence there. There were also a couple of helicopters that flew overhead over the send-off points and over the downtown Havana. There were at least two helicopters that flew overhead, clearly as a show of force to let people know that the deadline is in effect, that it is a serious deadline. But the rafters have been gone now for basically the past 24 hours. What we did see was just remnants of rafts left over at places that used to be major departure points for the rafters or balseros.
NPR's Maria Hinojosa. President Clinton has signed the $30 billion crime bill. The hotly contested legislation is aimed at making American streets safer. It will also support some members of Congress in their re-election bids. The president signed the legislation on the South Lawn of the White House in an elaborate ceremony today. Members of Congress were there, along with the Clinton cabinet, city mayors, law enforcement officials, and several other guests. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up more than 15 points at 3,875. The NASDAQ is up almost 5 points at 764. This is NPR. A lawyer for the Las Vegas Hilton Hotel says the woman who blew the whistle on the tailhook scandal should have been more aware of potential trouble at the Aviators Gathering in 1991. Former Navy Lieutenant Paula Coughlin is suing the hotel, which hosted the convention. She says she was sexually assaulted by drunken pilots and that hotel staff ignored their behavior because the meeting was so profitable. 80 other women also said they were sexually harassed there. The Hilton's lawyer says Coughlin was drinking herself and should have watched out. A jury will decide whether she will receive damages from the hotel. The judge says this trial could last as long as 5 weeks. Education Secretary Richard Riley is encouraging parents to be more involved in their children's education. Riley's campaign took him to Kentucky today. Chris Hoskin of member station WNKU reports from Highland Heights.
Riley has praised parents and teachers at a preschool in northern Kentucky. The education secretary commended their willingness to get involved.
Many parents I know are stretched to the limit, juggling jobs, trying to put food on the table, anxious about next month's job, doing all they can to keep body and soul together. But I believe that we're missing something far deeper in all of this rushing around. We're letting our children grow up, in a lot of cases, almost alone.
Riley urges parents to work alongside their children and set high standards. For National Public Radio, I'm Chris Hoskin in Highland Heights.
The government says consumer prices were up 0.3% for August. It's the third straight monthly gain. The Labor Department says inflation at the consumer level has risen 2.9% so far this year. Last year, the annual rate was 2.7%. The news is likely to calm inflation jitters, which surfaced last week when the government reported on inflation at the producer level. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Former First Lady Barbara Bush has written her memoirs. It's made news for revealing that she disagrees with her husband on abortion. Earlier today, we spoke about that disagreement and talked about her family life and her years as a public figure. We started at the very beginning with her childhood.
Well, I grew up in Rye, New York. I had a wonderful mother and father and two brothers and one sister. It was a town of 8,000 people, and it was a wonderful little town.
Now, your father became the publisher of McCall's and Red Book. Did you read those magazines when you were growing up?
Yes, I did read them. He worked all of his working life, really, in that particular business. And I did read them when I was growing up. They were not quite the same as they are now.
What were they like?
Well, they were more women's magazines and sort of genteel kind of stories.
And how did they affect your sense of what it would mean to become an adult?
Not very much. My father also was the president and the CEO of McCall Corporation. And they printed the McCall patterns. And that affected my childhood because we used to play dolls with them. He'd bring home the old catalogs, and we loved that.
Tell me something about your mother.
Well, my mother was very beautiful. She was a gardener. She had very little sense of humor. She made the world more beautiful, really. She did beautiful needlepoint. She was a wonderful, she ran a wonderful house. She had a lot of worries as a young woman, really, or a young mother, because we had a brother that was very ill, and she was a wonderful person.
Was this the brother? Oh, your brother was
my ill. Brother was very
oh,
ill.
Oh.
He's fine. Mm-hmm. He's great now. But it was 5 years of a lot of worry, and I don't think I realized as a child how hard that is on a mother.
You singled out the fact that your mother had very little sense of humor. Is that something you noticed as a child?
Well, I noticed it more as I grew older. She just did not. And I think everybody agreed she had very little sense of humor. But she had a great sense of beauty, and she certainly was a good, loving mother.
What did your brother have?
Well, he had a cyst in his arm, and they took chips from different parts of his body, bone chips, and put them into the arm, and we were never really told exactly what he had, but it took, after five very serious operations, it worked, and the chips grew, and he grew to be a wonderful, strong, loving, very athletic man.
When you were a girl, what were your fantasies about what you wanted to be as a woman, what you wanted your life to be like when you grew up?
I guess, like my mother's, I don't know. We just had a wonderful, very healthy outdoor childhood, and I think I had an older sister, and I guess I wanted to copy her and copy my mother. I later decided that I'd like to be a nurse, but then I met that marvelous George Bush, and the nursing went out the window.
How did you meet your husband, George Bush?
I met him at a dance in Greenwich, Connecticut, when I was 16, and he asked someone to introduce me to him, and we then became friends.
Were you a good dancer? Did you feel that this was a comfortable way to meet a boy?
Well, I was a good dancer. He was not a good dancer. And that's really how... In those days, you know, you went to a dance with either... You just went, or you went with a boy. But he did not expect to dance with you all night. You expected to dance with other people.
Mm-hmm.
And one... George did dance with me, and then they suddenly started to play a waltz, and George said, "Do you mind if we sit down, because I don't know how to waltz?" And we did sit down and talk, and he came to a party he knew I was going to be attending the next night, and sort of went on from there. I ought to tell you, read the book. It's in the book.
My guest is Barbara Bush, and she's just written her memoirs. No, I think... when you met, you were 16, he was 17, you were married 3 years later.
Mm-hmm.
He was a pilot in the war then.
Mm-hmm.
Did the war affect your feelings of urgency about getting married?
Absolutely. I know that my family and his would not have approved of our getting married at 19 and 20 if it hadn't been for the war and we knew he was going back overseas.
Your husband was in the oil business before entering politics, and I've read that you moved at least 11 times in the first 6 years of marriage, and he had to travel a lot, and you often had to manage the family alone. What were those years like for you? What were some of the stresses that you faced?
Well, for 20 years, George was in business, and we did move a lot, but we settled down in Midland, Texas, and... The same stresses everybody whose husband has a job out of town face. I mean, some of my children are going through that now. You have to be mother and father sometimes. But you forget those times. I remember thinking at times, they're wonderful children. They're beautiful and they're brilliant. But they haven't said one thing that makes them fascinating all week long. I want to talk to adults. Well, every mother feels that. But it's worth it. I mean, take the time to talk to them and read to them and help them grow up, and it's worth it. They're now the world's greatest living humans, so I guess it was fine.
Your second child, Robin, was diagnosed with leukemia when she was 3, and she died just a few months later. You write in your memoirs that the doctor said, "This is the advice I would give you. Don't tell anyone she's sick. Don't even try to treat her. Just take her home, make her as comfortable as you can, and let her gently slip away. And she'll probably die within 3 weeks."
Mm-hmm.
How did that advice sound at the time to you?
Well, it sounds just the way it sounds now. Probably was true, but you couldn't do that. You always hope there'll be a cure. And today that wouldn't happen. There has been a semi-cure for leukemia, really. So it was worth trying. It was hard on her. And it was certainly hard on George, who had to keep on in business and work, and it was hard on me and our family. But on the other hand, if you ever give up hope, you give up living.
Did you become more nervous about the health of your other children after losing one?
That's a good question. I haven't been asked that for a long time, but I do remember when one of the children or two of them had their tonsils out, someone saying to me, "Oh, well, after what you've been through, tonsils are nothing." And I said, "Well, after what I've been through, tonsils are worse than ever." I mean, I think everything becomes more valuable, and your children's health, which you used to take for granted, suddenly becomes very tentative. But I got over being quite so nervous about them.
Was it hard to find the balance between being protective and overly protective?
Yes, and thank heavens for George Bush, because he believes in independence, and he always gave the children independence, and he would trust them, and when I would maybe think they were more like me, that they shouldn't be trusted or something, he would say, "Of course they can drive across the country when they're 16. They have their license." I would panic, but they did it, and they're great kids.
There's one of the difficult parts of your life, according to your memoirs, was around 1975 when your husband became the head of the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
And you described that period as a period in which you were very depressed, lonely, and unhappy. And I just want to read a paragraph from your new memoirs. You write, "It is still not easy to talk about today, and I certainly didn't talk about it then. I felt ashamed. I had a husband whom I adored, the world's greatest children, more friends than I could see, and I was severely depressed. I hid it from everyone, including my closest friends, everyone but George Bush. He would suggest that I get professional help, and that sent me into deeper gloom. He was working such incredibly long hours at his job, and I swore to myself that I would not burden him. Then he would come home, and I would tell him all about it. Night after night, George held me weeping in his arms while I tried to explain my feelings. I almost wonder why he didn't leave me. Sometimes the pain was so great, I felt the urge to drive into a tree or an oncoming car. When that happened, I would pull over to the side of the road until I felt okay. Looking back on that period of your life, what do you think caused that incredible depression?
I'm pretty sure I know what caused it now. Stupidity on my part. But I think I was going through maybe menopause, and our children were gone for the first time, and it had been the first time that George had had a job in a number of years that I really couldn't share in, because I can't keep a secret. I still can't keep a secret, but having said that, I think all those things combined gave me that sort of really deep depression. But now there's a positive side to this story. I'm glad it happened now, although there was a physical pain then that went with it, and it wasn't very, it was an awful time. But having said that, I'm now much more sympathetic to people who have problems, and I really feel free to say to people, get help. There's help out there. My doctor, when I told him later and said, why didn't you help me? He said, well, why didn't you tell me? And I was embarrassed, and I just thought that my code said you ought to be strong and you can overcome things if you just think of others. Well, I think that's partially true, but I also think that there's, you can get chemical help that will help you over difficult times.
How'd you snap out of it?
I guess I outgrew it. I was lucky, and I'm very grateful for that. But I think it was, I still think it was good for me because I'm much more sympathetic to other people.
Let me ask you this. When he'd come home at night and you were crying.
Well, I wasn't crying all the time.
Okay, but you know, here's this question. Did you ever feel like, oh, God, he's got, you know, the world's secrets resting on his shoulders, and here
yes.
I am unhappy, and I'm taking up his time,
yes.
and that's bad for the United States of America?
No, I thought it was bad for just anyone to do that. I thought it was, no, I did, I felt selfish, and you see, that's sort of against my code. I may be selfish, but it's against my beliefs to think. I think you ought to try to think of others.
What else is in your code?
Well, decency and honesty, I hope, and all those nice things. But thinking of others, doing unto others, those are sort of in my code.
At the time of this depression, or I guess shortly afterwards, you told one magazine that you thought it was because of the women's movement, because the women's movement had made you think your life had been wasted.
Well, I thought that was a fourth ingredient into it, beside the no sharing in the job, the children gone, the menopause. I thought the women's movement at that time, it isn't so true anymore, sort of made women who stayed at home feel inadequate. I'm thinking that women who stay at home and raise their children are doing the most important thing they can do for them, their country.
Well, what do you think now?
I think
have
that
been,
now.
No, I mean, what do you think now have been the pros and cons of the women's movement?
Well, I think there have been lots of pros. I mean, equal pay for equal work is very, very important. And there's a lot of self-esteem that goes into that. But I also think that priorities should be your children. If you opt to have children, you ought to take care of them.
Barbara Bush is my guest. She's written her memoirs. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with former First Lady Barbara Bush. When your husband started his 1988 presidential campaign, you wrote in your diary one day that you knew he was the most qualified, but you didn't want him to run. What were your fears then about the campaign and the life that would follow if he became president and you became First Lady?
Well, that was just what I felt one day. I mean, you know, a diary is what you feel at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
It is not necessarily what you feel all the time. And I
But on those days when you had doubts, what were they?
Well, it just, the campaigning gets so ugly. And it's just some days you're just too tired to face all that. And maybe that's what I felt. I can't really remember the day you're talking about, okay. But I'm sure I wrote it. But I, when I wrote the book, I thought I ought to put in it every feeling because I'm trying to be honest.
What were your feelings about the emphasis on family values in your husband's campaign?
Well, they were right. You see signs now that say Dan Quayle was right, bumper stickers all around. Democrats are now pushing us over saying family values are important. He was right. George had a group of mayors come visit in his office when he was president, headed by Mayor Bradley of Los Angeles, and then some Republicans, some Democrats, big and little cities, and they all agreed on one thing only. The breakup of the American family, what was causing most problems in all their cities. That drugs and crime, school dropouts, teenage pregnancies, all those things go back to the breakup of the American family. Now, George didn't make that up. The mayors did. But that just reinforced what you and I know is true, that we may have different families now, different setups, but family is what's important, whether they're friends or it's just important. Every child deserves to have someone know their name.
I think in a way you just put your finger on something, which is that there's different kinds of families, and I think
That's
a
right.
lot of the debate was over what family values means and who's defining what a family is.
Well, you and I, we may not be able to define it, but we know what it is. We've got to get back to caring for our children.
Marilyn Quayle at the Republican convention said most women do not wish to be liberated from their essential natures as women.
I never understood what that meant.
Uh-huh. Did you talk to her about that?
No. I heard it, but I didn't quite understand what that meant. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's true. But anyway, I don't understand what it meant, tell you the honest truth.
What the essential nature of women means?
Well, the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because she'd gone on to say most of us love being wives and mothers, which gives our lives a richness that few men or women get from professional accomplishments.
Well, I don't agree with that, but that's what she thought, and that's fine. But I think the perception of what she was saying sounded sort of unlike Marilyn. She's a very warm, good mother, and she's
someone who's worked a lot, too. She's a lawyer.
Very bright woman. And she wanted to work, you know, but the job kept her from doing that, really.
No, it's interesting. I mean, although, you know, you dropped out of college to get married and raise your family, you've ended up having an incredible working life yourself. You were very prominent, especially in your role as First Lady, and you worked incredibly hard, both for your husband's campaigns, but also for literacy and other issues you took on. And I guess I'm wondering if you would have felt comfortable working that hard in a field that was separate from your husband, or if you only felt that you could allow yourself to spend that much time on a public life and a working life, knowing that it was really supporting your husband.
No, I wouldn't have been comfortable as the wife of the president, the vice president, working in another career. But then that would have been my choice. I'm not saying that it isn't something people should do, but I would not have been comfortable there. But I did work, I want to correct you a little bit, but I worked very hard all during the vice president's years when my children were gone, for literacy then too. I mean, I've been in the business now about 15 years. And I would not have been comfortable working for a living. But as a young mother, if my husband and I needed me to work, I wouldn't have been uncomfortable about that at all.
Barbara Bush is my guest. She's just written her memoirs. Now, as First Lady, you intentionally chose something very important and also very not controversial, literacy.
Well, but I chose the most important thing, I believe, and I've grown steadily to believe it's the most important cause I could have chosen.
Well,
education.
It's a very important cause.
The most.
But I'm wondering how important it was for you to choose something that wasn't controversial, too.
Well, not important to anyone but me. I mean, I wanted to choose something that would help the most people possible, would not necessarily cost more government money, and would not be controversial because, in my opinion, when you run for high office, you need a wife or a husband who, rather like Dennis Thatcher, will help you, not hurt you. And I felt that that would not hurt George, but would help the most Americans possible. And in honesty, not necessarily need more government money. Most literacy programs are done on by volunteers or through state programs.
What about the social causes that are behind the huge literacy rate? How did you feel like that should be taken into account?
If more people could read, write, and comprehend, we would have less people on the welfare rolls. We'd have less people. I mean, it just everything I worried about came back to that. Hunger, homeless, unemployed, pregnant teenagers, and I worried about a lot of things and still do. Would you just check those lists and you'll find that there's a disproportionate number of people who have not been taught to read.
It's a chicken and egg thing. You know, the other way of looking at it is that the more people that are poor, the more people that are on welfare, the more people that feel born into lives of hopelessness, the more literacy there's going to be. Illiteracy,
I mean, all right, but are you going to stand back on semantics, or are we going to try to do something about it? I'm trying to do something about it.
I guess, did you ever feel like that was... that some Republican policies of the 80s worked at cross purposes in the sense
of cutting back
certain social programs?
No, I did not, because I am absolutely dead convinced if you want it done wrong, let the federal government do it. That the states, we should put things back to the states and back to the cities. And we're taking too much money to the federal government and too little. Their job really should be to defend us.
Barbara Bush is my guest. She's just written her memoirs. I'm interested in hearing your response to Hillary Clinton's definition of her role as First Lady. I mean, she's taken on a policy issue that's been in the center of controversy right from the jump. Do you think that's an appropriate role for the First Lady?
Sure, if she wants to take it on. I mean, folks have different strokes or whatever that is, but yes, I have no criticism of her. You know, she's not the only First Lady who ever took on causes. Eleanor Roosevelt certainly was much more visible, much more in the public, really, than Hillary Clinton, and she took a big beating for it, too. But, I mean, each one does their own thing and does it their own way.
Did you have any role models, First Lady role models?
Well, I was always devoted to Lady Bird Johnson. And
a Democrat.
Well, that's right. I like her personally very, very much. I was very fond of, I don't know about role models, but very fond of Pat Nixon. I'm so old that I know that everybody does things their own way. And so I didn't have any feeling of, I've got to follow so-and-so or do like so-and-so. I did my own thing, and I immodestly think I did it very well. I raised public awareness of illiteracy, and I certainly raised millions of dollars for illiteracy, and I worked very hard to make our country more literate. We got the first literacy bill passed, thanks to George Bush, in 1991, and, I mean, I worked hard on that.
Barbara Bush. She's written her memoirs. Barbara Bush will be back with us in the second part of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Barbara Bush says she didn't always agree with her husband when he was president, but she wanted to keep a united front. Coming up, we talk about one of the few political issues she says she disagreed with him about, abortion. The former First Lady has written her memoirs. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a new reissue that he thinks any die-hard country music fan should love. It's called Webb Pierce, King of the Honky Tonk. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The crime bill is now law. President Clinton signed the $30 billion legislation this morning on the South Lawn of the White House. President Clinton says the bill is a matter of freedom. He says crime and fear have become so prevalent that the United States has lost its freedom.
Even this great law, the toughest and smartest crime bill in our history, cannot do the job alone. By its own words, it is still a law. It must be implemented by you, and it must be supplemented by you. Even when we put a new police officer on your block, the officer can't make you safe unless you come out of your home and help the officer do his or her job.
Under the law, some assault-style weapons are banned immediately. It also provides a way to put 100,000 police officers on the street and toughens the penalties for repeat offenders. A Clinton administration official says investigators believe Washington's National Airport radar found a small plane minutes before it crashed on the White House lawn. The official says the investigators believe the Secret Service was never notified. The White House says it's trying to confirm if this is true, and if so, why. The Secret Service is reviewing how the pilot made his way unchallenged through prohibited airspace and whether security procedures were followed. The Washington Post is quoting the brother of the pilot as saying his brother talked a year ago about crashing a plane into the White House. Primary elections will be held in many parts of the country today. Voters in 9 states will nominate candidates for governor, with the most contested races taking place in Minnesota and Rhode Island. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
In Minnesota, incumbent Arnie Carlson is facing State Representative Alan Quist in the race for the Republican nomination for governor. The race made national headlines when Quist, who has significant backing among conservative Christians, won his party's endorsement. But polls show Carlson remains ahead among voters. In Rhode Island, Governor Bruce Sundlin is fighting for his political life. Polls show him trailing State Representative Murth York. In Connecticut, voters will elect 2 candidates to vie for the seat being vacated by retiring Governor Lowell Weicker. Meanwhile, next door in New York, State Senator George Pataki is expected to win the Republican nomination for governor. He will go on to oppose Democratic incumbent Mario Cuomo in November. The race between Cuomo and Pataki is expected to be one of the most closely watched in the nation. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
On Wall Street this afternoon, stocks closed higher. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose almost 20 points to end the day at 3,879. Advancing issues led decliners by a narrow margin in heavy trading. This is NPR. A former U.S. treasurer in the Bush administration has been sentenced to 4 months in prison for tax evasion. Catalina Vasquez Villalpando was also sentenced on charges of obstruction of justice and conspiring to hide income received from a former employer. U.S. District Judge Thomas Hogan says he can find no basis to excuse her conduct. Villalpando will be placed on supervised release for 3 years after she gets out of jail, and for 4 months of that, she'll be on home detention, supervised by a probation officer. The House has joined the Senate in approving a measure that restricts imports of gasoline from foreign refineries that fail to meet U.S. environmental standards. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
The House voted to go along with a Senate amendment that bars the Environmental Protection Agency from changing rules on pollutant levels so foreign refineries can sell gas in the United States. The amendment has the support of both the oil industry and some environmental groups. It mainly affects imports from Venezuela and was attached to a Senate version of a $90 billion spending bill. Supporters of the Senate amendment on imported gasoline argued that Venezuela was getting special treatment through EPA rule revisions that allow it to sell dirty gas in the United States. But other lawmakers argued that Venezuela gas meets U.S. standards, and they contend that the Senate restrictions would drive up gasoline prices, particularly in the Northeast. The consumer group Citizen Action agreed. It said the restrictions would banish from the marketplace up to 100,000 barrels of imported reformulated gasoline. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
A published report says several hundred reservists could be called up for action in Haiti. The Washington Post reports the reservists could help keep order in Haiti after a possible U.S.-led invasion. Meanwhile, training starts today for Caribbean troops who would serve as Haitian peacekeepers. Soldiers are arriving at the U.S. base in Puerto Rico. They are the first troops to form a 1,500-member force comprised of 17 nations. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Barbara Bush. The former First Lady has just written her memoirs. In your memoir, you write a bit about abortion, and you say that you don't like abortions, but you think a woman should have the right to make that decision for herself. How did you reach that conclusion?
This is how I reached the conclusion. I agree with George Bush 99% of the way. And, he and I both believe that abortion is permissible when you have rape, incest, and the life of the mother at stake. We both agree, at least I agree, the first trimester only. I do not agree. Some states allow abortions up to the third trimester. I do not agree with that. We both think you should have parental consent. We believe that's very important. We both believe very, very strongly that education is the answer, that we should be educating our children. And this is a little off the subject. I'll get back to your question in a minute. But I am so offended when I keep hearing that schools should take the place of mothers and fathers and ministers. And we expect our teachers to do almost everything but teach. And then we criticize them for not having the time to teach. My own feeling is that mothers and fathers should be talking to their children about sex and about preventatives. I just think we should be saying to our children early and listening to them that sex is something you save for later. It's very important. It's dangerous, and you can have babies, and we shouldn't expect the schools to do that. Now, how did I get to that conclusion?
Yeah, thank you.
Well, when push comes to shove, I myself would never have an abortion. But having said that, I can't make that judgment for someone else. So that's how I feel. But we both agree that 1.6 million abortions a year is absolutely outrageous, and we're doing a lousy job educating our children.
So in these rare circumstances, when you found yourself disagreeing with your husband on something, would you try to change his mind, or would you just accept the fact that you'll disagree on this one?
We talked, like I hope other healthy marriages, and then we agreed to disagree. We never argued, we never fought about it. We both gave our opinions, and that was that.
So when your husband was president,
mm-hmm.
and you disagreed with him on something,
mm-hmm.
what did you see as your job in terms of either going public with an opinion or making sure no one found out about it?
My job, I'm not sure it was my job, but my belief is that unless you're courageous enough to run for office yourself, you can tell your husband or your wife what you think quietly in your own private time, and then you present a united front, and I believe in that. If I had run for office, I would hope George would pay me the same courtesy.
Well, did that sometimes put you in uncomfortable situations where people would assume you supported something like the Republican platform on abortion when you didn't?
No, because I really don't think the party platform matters. That is not a good thing to say, but I can't remember a word the Democrats said. I can't remember a word the Republicans said. I think platforms should be very broad-based and inclusive, not exclusive. So I can't ever remember a campaign where I ran on a platform.
But still, people associated the Republican Party at the presidential level with a strong anti-abortion stance. Mm-hmm. So
It never came up in a campaign, truthfully.
Abortion?
No, the platform.
No, but forgetting the platform a second, abortion came up a lot, and I'm just wondering if you ever felt very uncomfortable knowing that what
no,
you believe.
No, because I'm 99% with George Bush on mm-hmm, that. Mm-hmm. It did not. I really think it's not a political. It should not be a political thing. I'm uncomfortable talking about it only because I really don't think we should be spending so much time. You know, nobody cares about it truthfully in politics.
But the point was, it became a political thing during that campaign.
Mm-hmm. I know it. Every campaign, I've never been to one that didn't have it. Seriously.
So, just to sum up, you weren't terribly uncomfortable by having that particular.
No, I'm not going to get uncomfortable for you because we agree on almost okay. Not just abortion. We have been married so long that I agree with George Bush on darn near 100% of everything, and the two or little things I didn't agree with him on made no difference. They weren't my top priority. My top priority is literacy. My top priority is a strong country. I mean, they're just that I think literacy will make us. If we can teach our children to read, write, and comprehend, we'll have less teenage pregnancies, we'll have less people seeking abortions, we'll have less drugs, we'll have a more educated workforce, we'll have 85% of our people in prison are functionally illiterate.
When you mentioned the two things that you disagreed with your husband about, is the other one you're referring to gun control of semi-automatic weapons?
Yes. I mean, I'm not even sure I think he's against semi-automatic weapons being, but it doesn't even matter now. Who cares what he or I are for? We're out of the business.
Are you glad to be able to say that?
Yes, I am.
Barbara Bush is my guest. The former First Lady has written her memoirs. We'll be back after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Barbara Bush. When you became First Lady, or when your husband first started running for president, you know, mm-hmm. image is so important in American politics today. Were there ever any attempts at quote, makeovers for you?
Well, you've read the book, I can tell. There were a few, but George always said, you're great the way you are. Don't try to change. And, you know, as a little girl, my dad used to say all the time, remember, he used to embarrass me to death and say it as I'd go out the door maybe with a date. It's nice to be natural, and you're naturally nice. And I wanted to kill him because I was hoping to impress someone with how sophisticated I was. But having said that, that's probably true. I decided that I would not, after a little struggle, that I would not try to be something I wasn't.
Was there a period when you did try to be something that you weren't?
Well, I dyed my hair for years. I was white-headed when I was in my 30s, and I dyed my hair for a number of years. But I gave that up. But I try to be neat and clean, look nice.
You know, Mary Madeline, in her memoirs, you know, co-written with James Carville, mm-hmm. she writes about you, you can never be bad or rude in Barbara Bush's presence. She makes you have better posture.
Oh, good. I loved her book, incidentally. I thought it was a lovely love story. I saw her before I read the book and told her I'm going to read hers, not his. But I do love the book.
So what did you think when she said she makes you have better posture?
I thought that was wonderful, and I'm going to be around her a lot.
Now, how do you feel about your sons going into politics after living this life yourself? You've seen what's good about it, what's difficult about it. A lot of people don't wish their professions on their children because they've seen so much of the hardships from it.
We didn't wish this on our children. These are two grown-up men, mm-hmm. both of whom worked very hard in the private sector, have been fairly successful, have raised good families. And I can't tell you how proud it makes me feel of them. And it sort of vindicates, because they both worked very hard in the campaign. They both saw how ugly it can get. And yet they both still want to serve their country in this way. And I really feel as though I'm so proud of them, I can't believe it.
During the last presidential campaign, there was a lot of investigation or a lot of allegations about both your husband and Bill Clinton.
Don't put them in the same breath, please.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, one is a rumor and one were allegations. I mean, rumors happen in every campaign. They've happened in every campaign we've ever had, but it's very different.
So we're talking about the same thing here, which is...
We're talking about different things.
What I mean is the subject we're referring to is the same, affairs.
Yes.
The rumors about affairs.
Mm-hmm.
Is this, do you think, an appropriate subject for the press to investigate? Where would you draw the line about what you thought was fair and unfair?
Well, I think you can't control someone who stands up and says someone attacked me or someone did something to me, rather than just passing rumors that were never happened and never were around. I think that's a big difference. But having said that, there are always in campaigns ugly things. And it's let's hope they'll stop unless you can prove them. But to reprint something that was never, that never happened, was looked into forever and never ever happened, is crazy. And it's unfair.
So you're saying that you thought there was more credence in the Bill Clinton story?
I didn't say that.
Okay, you were saying
two women stood up and said that.
You were saying don't say this in the same breath. So I'm
well, I feel that way. I mean, two women stood up and accused him of something. I can't do anything about that. But this was just ugly. There's a difference. And let's not talk about it anymore. It didn't happen, and I don't want to talk about it. It's just a rumor, and you and I are perpetuating something that isn't true.
Can I ask you what kind of report card so far you would give Bill and Hillary Clinton?
No, I think, you know, one thing is when you're president, you have a very hard job, and there's a loyal opposition out there that can give report cards. George and I have sort of taken the vow that we're not going to make their life more difficult.
And why did you take that vow?
Because it's a hard job, and that we've done our part. Now let's give someone else a turn. There's loyal opposition. Bob Dole does a great job, and there are others out there who can make the report cards.
So many articles about you have mentioned that your pearls, which you so often wear, are mm-hmm. fake pearls.
Really?
Yeah. Have you ever noticed how many times that's mentioned?
I thought they were real.
Yes, right.
Darn it.
So is this intentional that... you're not wearing real pearls?
Do you know how much real pearls this size would cost?
Uh-huh.
And besides that, my head would be cut off to get them. But...
you have the money to buy it, right?
No. Nobody could buy my pearls. And I wouldn't want them if they were real. They're sort of fun. And besides that, they're big enough to cover my wrinkles.
I have one last question for you. It seems to me that you are a very strong person with a very firm sense of when to say yes and when to say no.
Oh, I hope so.
And with the press, too, of when to say, we've spoken about this a lot, I don't care to answer that. And I wonder if you, where you feel you developed the sense of that. I know one of the things that a lot of professional women say is that one of the hardest things for them has been learning how to say no, because so many women they feel grew up in a time when they were socialized to be accommodating and to say yes and to want to be liked. And then you get to a point professionally where it's not about being liked, it's about making the right choices and about saying no when it's time to say no. Was that a hard thing for you to learn?
That's the funniest question I ever heard. But the truth is, my mother told me, say no.
Uh-huh.
I don't know.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Barbara Bush, she's written her memoirs. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, today's the last day of the Cuban migration. What do you have on the change in policy?
We will be covering that from this country, and we have a report from Maria Hinojosa in Cuba. We also are taking a look at the congressional decision to hold a debate about whether or not the president should invade Haiti. Claudio Sanchez has a piece on the condition of schools in this country as the school year begins. And Wendy Kaufman reporting from Seattle on whether or not the thrust reversers could have caused the crash of the U.S. Air flight. We'll also be taking another look at the population conference.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The country singer Webb Pierce died 3 years ago, largely forgotten. But in his heyday, in the 1950s, Webb Pierce had no fewer than 12 number one hits. A new CD collection called Webb Pierce, King of the Honky Tonk, is bringing renewed attention to the singer. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
Wondering, wondering, who's kissing you? Wondering, wondering if you're wondering too. Every hour through the day since you've been away, I keep wondering, yes, wondering if you're wondering too. I pray every night.
For me, Webb Pierce is the litmus test for people who say they like country music. If you can't find pleasure in Webb's piercing yowl, I'm sorry. You're a tin horn and you should just stick to your little Mary Chapin Carpenter records. Webb Pierce is in many ways everything contemporary country music is not. Rough-edged, lower-middle-class vulgar, and all too aware of the seamy side of life. Pierce sang about heartbreak and ruined marriages with a sob in his throat, and when it comes to drinking songs, he recorded the ultimate country tune about alcoholism, the bleak and gorgeous There Stands the Glass.
There stands the glass that will ease all my pain, that will settle my brain. It's my first one to take. Stands the glass that will hide all my tears, that will drown all my fears. Brother, I'm on my way. I'm wondering where you are tonight. I'm wondering if you are all right. I wonder if you think of me in my misery. There stands the glass, fill it up to the brim, till my troubles grow dim. It's my first one to take.
Born in 1921 in West Monroe, Louisiana, Webb Pierce specialized in the sort of stripped-down, direct form of country music that came from having to capture the attention of drunks in bars and honky-tonks all over the country. His high voice was echoed by the steel guitar playing of Bud Isaacs, and Pierce's hits popularized the keening sound of this instrument.
I'm losing my blues more.
you by my side. And oh, how I cried the day you said goodbye. Day by day, I'm losing my blues. More and more, I'm forgetting about you.
Webb Pierce was a big, showy star. He wore garish stage outfits such as a gold lamé suit appliqued with little cloth records that had the names of all his hits. He drove a Cadillac decorated with $1,000 silver dollars. You can go and see his guitar-shaped swimming pool in Nashville. But Pierce wasn't just a showboater. You can hear his influence in singers ranging from Willie Nelson to Jimmy Dale Gilmore. And today's country music could use a lot more of his risky passion.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Webb Pierce, King of the Honky Tonk.
I got me a room and a cheap hotel. My head was a-spinning and I didn't feel well. I laid right down and tried to go to sleep. A band kept a-playing and I joined underneath. I picked up my pillow and I covered up my head. But the band kept a-playing and a-shaking my bed.
Honky-tonk, all night long. Honky-tonk, same old song. Honky-tonk, my money's all gone. Honky-tonk, she done me wrong.
I turned and I tossed and I couldn't go to sleep, 'cause the band kept a-playing with a honky-tonk beat.
Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Salad, and Naomi Person, with Sue Spolin and Barbara Bogave. Research assistance from Becky Cohen. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Gone. She took all my money and left me all alone. I'm trying to forget her, but I don't know what to do. The honky-tonk song keeps a-leaking through. I picked up my filter and I covered up my head, but the band keeps a-playing and a-shaking my bed.
Honky-tonk, all night long. Honky-tonk, same old song.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.